it's time to meet up and catch up at the Weekend Water Cooler. Now, here's your host, Gene Bolduc.
Welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler. I am joined this weekend, I'm so grateful for it, as I always am, by Dr. Aaron Keck.
Hello.
Dr. Keck, happy to have you.
Happy to be here.
We are transitioning our off-microphone conversation about golf.
We may have been sitting here preparing for this show for the last 15 minutes.
That's true. We could have been. We'll see how much of it, you know, trickles in.
When you got a hard start time for the show and you show up a little bit early, then, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
You got to kill time some way, shape, or form.
That's right. And killing things, that's what we're doing. Yes, that's what we're doing. I should look at what the time says on there, roughly. Okay, so what happens is we're talking about golf and people who cheat at golf. Not to name any Trump names, one of the things that I love about golf, at least the way it's supposed to be, is that it's supposed to have a certain amount of integrity in it.
Yes.
And that to me,
as opposed to what? Like what do you enter into? You're like, I assume that this has no integrity whatsoever. Like
politics.
But even politics should have integrity. Like what is something
right.
that should not have integrity? That you go in with the intention of cheating and assuming that everyone else is going to cheat, and this is good, this is okay, this is the way it morally ought to be.
Getting on a bathroom scale at the beginning of your doctor's visit. It comes to my mind immediately.
I've been doing that all wrong.
Yeah, right. No, you're not supposed to add all the things that you were carrying. You're supposed to practically disrobe in order to get on the scale.
Right, right.
You know, which is not really telling them how much weight you're walking around with every day. But, you know, within a pound or two, it's close enough.
Yeah.
It's close enough for government work, as we say, right? But the thing about golf that I especially appreciate, and this is not true for other sports, other competitive sports, is that the player is expected to make rulings on certain things. So if your ball is over the line and into the hazard, if you're taking relief because your ball is in a place where you're allowed to take two club lengths of relief, you're expected to do that measurement and place the ball yourself.
Correct.
Or make the ruling on whether or not you get relief if you're standing on or near a drain in the middle of the fairway. A lot of these things, deciding about who's away, a lot of little things and sometimes some big things. And the player is the one who makes the ruling.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the pro game, you see guys, they have PGA officials. The official is there to advise the player, but the player makes the ruling. And,
yes.
And you know, I appreciate that.
And I was thinking about this in the context of, like, tennis, where if
right.
you're playing someone and you're just on the court one day, then you
right.
have to make your own rulings.
You make
but in
your
a
own
professional
calls, right.
tournament match, then they have an official who is
right.
responsible for making
And if you're
rulings.
In a sanctioned tournament, you might have a USTA official calling the lines.
Who is responsible
for making
the decisions.
Or at least being an umpire
right.
at the match. And making, you know, being the final arbiter of these things. But generally speaking, in golf, you know, it's the players who make these decisions. And it does tend to promote, and they like to talk about this a lot, it promotes integrity in the game and the idea that the players being aware of the rules and observing the rules and running the game by the rules is what makes the game fair and what makes it fun. That, you know, it is, after all, a game. G-A-M-E, game, as in for fun, something you do for fun. And what this reminds me of, in many ways, is how democracy is supposed to work. You're supposed to compete.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to have this this discussion of ideas and competition in the marketplace of ideas about how to govern yourself. And this is a almost uniquely American exercise. Not uniquely, but, you know, we're Americans are known for this.
Yes.
And so one of the things that should be the most important thing about running this exercise is making sure it's fair.
Correct.
So that on election day, when all the votes are counted and everyone who should be eligible to vote has had that opportunity, Then we count it up and we have a decision about what most people want to do. It's elegant in its simplicity.
Yes.
And yet here we are in our state with a fairly complex picture of gerrymandering. And so Aaron and I have...
And here we arrive at the topic for today.
And here we arrive at, you know, actually 2 hours into the show.
Five minutes. You and I have had shows where we have intended, where we have sat down intending to have a conversation about X, and at no point during the show do we ever get to X. On
When we're winding up, we say, and one day, by the way, we should talk about X, which is why we came here, but never mind.
So we got to gerrymandering 5 minutes in. I think that's a record speed
for us. And there actually is this connection. It's true that there's a connection with golf, which is that when you have players who cheat in golf, if they're in competitive events, if you're out playing with your buddy on Saturday, I don't care if you didn't place your ball right on the green when you putt, or if it got close but didn't go in, but you count it like it did.
Yes.
I don't care about these things because they're really not, they're not good, but they're not subject to, they're not messing up
because
the game
it's
for
golf,
other people.
Right. It's not messing up the game for other people, and it's not messing up life for the people who are competing in it.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Now, if they expect to get away with that when they play in your town championship or something, or a tournament for charity where, you know, you kind of still care about who wins and you want the trophy to mean something if you win, for example.
Or if you're with someone and you're like, I don't care to make it interesting, and now you're betting $100 on the outcome.
And then if the ball doesn't go in, then the ball doesn't go in, right? Yeah.
And there's something at stake as opposed to just people having a good time.
I have yet to find that it is untrue that if you play golf with a person, especially someone you work with, how they conduct themselves in this area is pretty indicative of how they are in terms of their integrity and their working relationship with you. I've played golf with a couple of bosses, and I can tell you that's turned out to be pretty true. So okay, I'll just leave that there. But anyway, what we have is our gerrymandering situation in North Carolina. And I wanted to ask you to give us a little background about that. And then we've had a fairly recent turn in this trial that is ongoing and is far from completed, but it does look like maybe it's turning in the right direction. I don't want to give away the ending because I don't know the ending.
Well, the ending hasn't happened yet.
We don't know the ending yet.
It's an ongoing story.
But it does look like it's kind of making a turn in the right direction. When did this start exactly? When did the lawsuit start? Do you know?
Oh, the lawsuit. Oh, God, no. So the thing about the gerrymandering fight in North Carolina is, and let's just focus on this decade, because every single time with gerrymandering, you have the census that's taken every 10 years, 1990, 2000, 2010, 2020 coming up. And after the census is taken, then on the national level, they make decisions about how many congressional districts each state receives. And it's fairly consistent from decade to decade, but there's always some states that gain seats, some states that lose seats. And then based on that, the state, the individual state, has to go and redraw the district lines based on not just, oh, we've gained a seat or we've lost a seat, but also how population has shifted within the state, because you want every district, and it's not just you want every district. There's now a legal constitutional requirement that every district have roughly the same number of people in it. And in the U.S. now today, it's a little bit more than 700,000 people per district. So if you've got this mass influx of population into, say, the Triangle area, where the population of the Triangle has really exploded in the last 10 years, and all of the surrounding counties have lost population to the Triangle, that affects the way the district lines have to be drawn. And then the same thing happens on the state level. The state legislative district lines have to be drawn. So that's the state house and the state senate, and they're drawn in the same way. You've got this one person, one vote rule. All of the districts have to have the same population. The districts have to be redrawn every 10 years based on the census. They're redrawn by the people who are in the legislature and have a direct personal interest in drawing the lines in a particular way to benefit themselves as individuals and whatever party they happen to belong to. So you have now lawsuit, and that is gerrymandering, the act of drawing right. the district lines to benefit yourself or your party or your group, whatever group that should be. So racial gerrymandering right. is also, unfortunately, a common practice. Racial gerrymandering is definitely unconstitutional. That's the 15th Amendment protecting voting rights. Partisan gerrymandering benefiting your party over another. There's no specific provision in the Constitution right. that explicitly says partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. So you've got to interpret the Equal Protection Clause, the guarantee of equality under the law. Well, does that apply to Democrats versus Republicans? If you draw the lines to benefit Democrats or to benefit Republicans, does that deny equality under the law to whichever side gets disadvantaged? There have been several Supreme Court cases. Most recently, earlier this year, the Supreme Court hasn't ever ruled that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. Earlier this year, they ruled that the federal courts don't really have a say or any authority in deciding whether it's unconstitutional. But you can also file lawsuits on the state level.
Right.
And the end result of all of that I just said is that every decade there are lawsuits claiming racial gerrymandering on the U.S. congressional district lines. There are right. lawsuits claiming racial gerrymandering on the state legislative district lines. There are lawsuits claiming partisan gerrymandering on the U.S. congressional district lines. There are lawsuits claiming partisan gerrymandering on the state legislative district lines. And you can have all four of those lawsuits in the federal courts and in the state courts.
Running simultaneously.
So which of the eight right. lawsuits? Oh, and every oh,
which
time.
Which one do I mean? Yeah.
And every time. The people challenging gerrymandering get a favorable ruling from the courts. The legislature then has to go back and redraw the district lines. But of course, it's the same people drawing the district lines. So they're going to do as much as they possibly can to once again draw the district lines in a way that benefits themselves and disadvantages their opponents. So you have another round of lawsuits once that's done, because that's what happens when you let people make important decisions when they have a personal stake in the outcome. So which of these 16 lawsuits are you referring to here?
Well, we're going to find that out when we return. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. We're talking with Dr. Aaron Keck. You will not be billed for this seminar in American political history.
I am not that kind of doctor.
Yeah, well, no, he's a pretty good doctor. The doctor will return in just a few minutes. Thanks for listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Okay, we're back with Aaron Keck, and we're talking about your friend Jerry, gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just saying that I imagine that when this provision in the Voting Rights Act was killed by the Supreme Court, when racism ended with the election of Barack Obama, according to the Chief Justice.
So you're talking about the Shelby County versus Holder Supreme Court case?
Yeah, I guess. The one that said that southern states that were covered by the Voting Rights Act that had to clear any changes in elections and mm-hmm. and I guess apportionment and redistricting, their redistricting maps had to be cleared by the Justice Department
mm-hmm.
because they had such a history of manipulation.
You know, I honestly don't know how much that case affected gerrymandering. So as soon as that Supreme Court ruling got handed down, then southern states had kind of a blank check to
right.
rewrite their voting laws. And that's when you had, for
right.
instance, North Carolina coming in with its
voter
ID, which was voter ID and
right,
several
exactly.
other provisions
right.
that were all kind of designed in the sense of, oh, we don't have to. No one's watching over our shoulder anymore.
You know,
we can
like
enact whatever voting laws
we want. It's like
when
your teacher's out and you have that lazy substitute teacher. And you know you're going to watch a movie that day.
Substitute teacher that's so lazy that they don't even bother to show up.
Or they sit in the corner and sleep while you're watching a movie in class.
Yeah.
And the class ends up being a zoo because there's just no...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that was about voter ID, and that was about early voting and all kinds of requirements about the process of going to the polls and voting and when and how and where. I don't know if that ruling had too much to do with gerrymandering. Unfortunately, I'm not 100% sure, because the issues with gerrymandering go back actually literally centuries.
We call it gerrymandering now.
It was actually originally gerrymandering.
Who is Gary anyway?
Elbridge Gary is who it was named after. Elbridge Gary was the governor of Massachusetts, and he orchestrated a redrawing of the state legislative district lines to benefit his party in this particular case. And they were drawn in such a cockamamie way. Like, they were just so obviously ridiculously drawn districts. Like, they snaked all over the place. And one of the districts looked like a salamander, so they called it a gerrymander.
Okay.
And from that, we get gerrymandering. Elbridge Gary was one of the first governors of Massachusetts after the Constitution was ratified. He was also James Madison's vice president from 1808 to 1812. And that's the guy that started gerrymandering. So that's how long we've been dealing with this as an issue, because literally from the beginning, the Constitution kind of leaves it up to the states to figure out elections for themselves for the most part. There's a couple of constitutional rules, like one person, one vote. Every district has to have the same number of people in it. The right to vote can't be denied to people on the basis of color or sex or gender or anyone 18 and over can't be denied the right to vote based on that. And you can't charge a poll tax. That's the 24th Amendment, I think. But other than that, states are kind of free to do it however they want.
Yeah, and by the way, this year, this cycle, next year specifically, that's probably going to be one of the main things that saves us as a republic, I mean.
Yeah.
Because if the federal government, as it's currently comprised, I don't know. I think that we would be in really big trouble if the federal government somehow was responsible for running elections. First of all, I think that the federal government would call it off.
Yeah.
I think if Trump could cancel the election next year, he might do it. And because he cannot. I mean, I think that's a really important protection that we have as citizens, is that you don't have one election. You have 50 elections.
And you have even more than that.
And the territories.
And each individual county. I mean, we're seeing this at the state level in North Carolina, where different counties run their elections different ways. Some counties use paper ballots. Some counties use touchscreen.
Right.
The State Board of Elections is meeting just this week to make decisions about that. In fact, by the time this airs, the meeting will have already happened.
I hope they decided to toddle on out to Orange County and see how Orange County does it, because I always have the highest confidence in our election process. I love that we use paper ballots. I don't ever want to stop using them.
I agree with that.
Man, I like that you, the voter, put your machine right in there and watch it click that it counted it. Whatever the system is that they use, I want us to keep on using it.
And then you can recount very easily if that becomes an issue. Yeah.
And while we're talking about this, people who have concerns about whether or not their vote gets counted, one of the tactics that I've heard advocated, if you live in an area that uses electronic touchscreens and other methods that maybe don't have a paper ballot backup. Every county, I think, in America has absentee balloting.
Yes.
And that means that if you're going to be out of town, and I was in the 2016 election, 2016? Yeah. I was going to be out of the state, so I early voted. And in 2000, I did that also because my mom was in the hospital. And so I voted before I
left. Man, don't do that ever again. You jinxed it.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, these are not – that's a good point. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I'll be in town. I promise. I've just set my calendar no matter what happens, not leaving. Anyway, some of the methods that they recommend are, you know, vote by absentee ballot. Mm-hmm. If you don't have early voting in your state, you do have absentee voting. And in terms of tampering with the ballots, that a lot more Republicans than Democrats vote by absentee ballot. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of the Republicans setting their sights on tampering, it's probably not going to be on absentee ballots because that's how the military votes, for mm-hmm. example. And you can't tell by the ballot in the envelope and so forth what it is. Unless, of course, you do what they did
in the Ninth District.
In the Ninth District, which is to send people to illegally come out to your house and collect up your ballot. But
and to the General Assembly's credit, that's now been addressed.
I think even that was beyond the pale.
That was super illegal when it was happening.
It was just super illegal, not merely illegal.
That's not a technical legal category, but super illegal, I think,
so
is a fair description.
So if you're concerned about your vote not being counted, go out and get yourself an absentee ballot and mm-hmm. vote that way. If you're going to vote, early vote, or vote at your polling place on Election Day, be sure you check your registration. You can do that in North Carolina online and make sure everything's spelled correctly and so forth, so you won't have any trouble checking in. Even if you do check in, they have to give you a provisional ballot. Mm-hmm. And if the vote is close, those will be counted, I guess. Provisional ballots, I think, if it's really lopsided,
those will be counted.
If it's really lopsided and the win for one is greater than the number of provisional ballots,
that
they
is
probably
true
won't
though.
Count
the provisional ballots don't necessarily they don't go out of their way to pull out those provisional ballots if it's not a close election.
Right.
I am really happy, and I think we've talked about this before. The ninth district, all of those shenanigans, was for the congressional race. That was to get, was it Mark Walker?
Yeah.
It was Leslie Dowless was his name, Leslie McRae Dowless, and he was working for Mark Walker to try to get him elected. So we collected all of these absentee ballots. Some of them hadn't been filled out yet. Apparently some of them got filled out by him and his people, mm-hmm. like whatever all went on. But the congressional election was not the only election on those ballots. So I am actually very, very happy, and I think we're all very fortunate in North Carolina that a lot of those state-level down-ballot races, like the six constitutional amendments, which were all kind of important, that it didn't come down to a handful of votes in either direction. Because if it had, then
– holy smokes.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I mean, as much as, you know, the four constitutional amendments that passed, not a huge fan of any of the four, and a couple in particular I really wish hadn't passed. But I'm glad if they passed that they passed by wide enough margins that all of that stuff that went on down there didn't matter.
Because we would have been Florida right now.
Circus if that had been
the case. Yeah, that's the polite term for it. We have a different term.
Yeah, that also begins with C, actually, that I almost just said.
Oh, my. Yes. Does it rhyme with cluster something? Yes.
It doesn't rhyme with cluster something.
It is cluster something. And you know, with any luck, we'll be back with more with Aaron Kack and his cluster after this brief message from advertisers who we hope are still with 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. We're back talking with Aaron Kack, and we're talking gerrymandering, and I'm just reading to him this segment from this wonderful editorial in the News and Observer that says the recent trial, one of the 16 trials,
showed that we're talking about the trial. It's challenging partisan gerrymandering of state legislative district lines on the state level in the state courts.
And it's saying after the courts threw out the
testimony just wrapped up and we're waiting for the judges to make their decision.
And the Republican defendants said they couldn't hold public hearings and draw new maps in time for a special election. The court reluctantly agreed. The trial showed that more than 90% of the new maps the Republicans used in the 2018 election had already been drawn by their map maker, the late Thomas Hofeller, a nationally known consultant who has been called the Michelangelo of gerrymandering. Or is it Michelangelo?
Michelangelo.
And you just told me that, you know, there that was with the maps that he had drawn. And then after he died, his daughter
was going through files and documents and discovered all of these maps, all of this correspondence that suggested all of this. And I don't exactly know what the rationale is for placing the phone call, but got in touch with the plaintiffs in this case and said, "Hey, I've got something you might be interested in." Just like that scene in the legal thriller where, like, they're meeting the secret shadowy informer
in the garage,
right?
Yeah.
And they're
all the president's map makers.
I think so. Yeah, it's kind of what it comes down to.
He said, you know,
but in this case, I think they met in a coffee shop, so much less cinematic, but kind of the same outcome.
Yeah.
But yeah, like this is what has been going on, and we're really focusing on all of the shady stuff that's been going on with the drawing of legislative districts in North Carolina this decade. But fair to say that the same shadowy stuff was going on the decade before. This was when Democrats were in control of the General Assembly. Gerrymandering was going on
then, too. And 100 years ago, it was 10 times this.
Oh, yeah.
You know it
was.
We just didn't know about it.
The one thing that has changed, like we were talking about Elbridge Gerry, more than 200 years ago, and gerrymandering has been a thing ever since, the one thing that has changed, and this is where Thomas Hofeller comes in, and the Red Map Project was the name of it. They use computer technology now. So we now have much more specific information about voters, and we've got increasingly sophisticated computer programming technology that we can use if we want to put in all of this voter information and basically write a program to tell the computer, okay, draw legislative district lines that will maximize Republican representation in the General Assembly. Hit enter, wait a couple hours or a couple minutes. I don't know how computers work. This is why I'm not in that business. Wait
absolutely
a little while. The computer spits out information. You present it to the lawmakers who still have the power to draw the district lines, and they say, well, here you go. And those are the districts.
And they know pretty well. There is so much data available on voters and their patterns and who they are.
Yeah.
Their identities, broadly speaking.
And you actually don't even need that much information. Like the amount of information that's publicly available is really not that extensive. You can find out information about you can find out information about who's registered to vote, where they live, are they registered with a particular party or not, which political party they're registered with,
when have they voted.
Yes, and based pretty much on that, I think, you can very effectively draw district lines that will lock political parties in place. Unless there's just a massive sweep election, and it really doesn't matter at that point,
or like last
2018.
Year. Yeah.
And to the point where elections from that point on really don't matter. And we have seen this in North Carolina, and the statistic that I always go back to, because this is so telling, is the U.S. congressional representation for North Carolina in 2012 in 2010. It was a big Republican sweep year that year.
Yep. Yep.
And you ended up with, I think, like 8-5, something like that. I can't remember the exact number, Republican representation
right.
in North Carolina. But right. after that, the district lines got redrawn. You've got 13 congressional districts in North Carolina. 2012 was a pretty good year for Democrats.
Yeah.
Republicans ended up with a 10-3 advantage in North Carolina. 2014 was a really big year for Republicans.
Yes.
Republicans ended up with a 10-3 advantage in North Carolina. 2016 leaned a little bit Republican, but it was really close to 50-50. Republicans ended up with a 10-3 advantage in North Carolina. 2018 was a big blue wave, tsunami, whatever word you want to use to describe it. Huge
right.
year for Democrats. Republicans ended up with a 10-3 advantage in North Carolina. 9-3, actually, because of the shenanigans
because,
in
right,
the
right, right.
In the ninth
in
district.
The ninth,
so
right.
maybe it'll end up being 9-4. But that is how little elections matter now when you have gerrymandering that is so sophisticated that you can use it to lock yourself in place. And that is why it
can
is.
Can they fix this before the next election is
yes.
my question.
Yeah, they can. They can fix it tomorrow if they want to. They could fix it today if they want to. I don't think there's any rule against the General Assembly meeting on a weekend. Because what it ultimately comes down to is the fact that we in North Carolina, and we're not alone, a lot of other states do it the same way, but it's ridiculous no matter where you are. We allow lawmakers to draw their own district lines. And it's a really good bumper sticker slogan, but it's true that lawmakers should not be choosing their voters. Voters
should be
choosing
way. Right.
their lawmakers.
Right.
But we've got a system, and we've had it in place for centuries, that allows lawmakers to choose their voters. And we've gotten to the point now, and technology has gotten to the point now, where they can do that in a way that is so effective that they can effectively lock themselves into power forever if they want to.
Don't say that. Don't say forever.
I mean, there's no forever, but
yeah.
for an indefinite extended period of time, really regardless of how elections shake out. And the way to get around that problem is to take the power of redrawing the district lines out of the hands of lawmakers
right.
and put it in the hands of people who don't have a direct personal stake in the outcome. And that is why we need
commission.
A
right.
nonpartisan redistricting commission.
All right.
Yep. That's which they can enact that again within a week if they want to.
And if
they
there,
can pass
if
that bill, send
pressure,
it to the governor, he'll sign
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
It'll happen.
Yeah, I mean, we can't do it by executive order. It has to be a law.
You can't do it by executive order.
It's too bad, because Cooper would have done it by now.
If
you could do it by executive order, it'd be undone so quickly.
In 2019 America, let's not rely on executive orders to solve all of our problems.
I totally agree.
But we can rely on the General Assembly, and if the General Assembly is unwilling to do it, which, I mean, kind of understandably they are, because the people who are in
right.
power right now benefit from the system being the way it is, then you got to rely on the courts. The federal courts earlier this year kicked the can down the road and absolved themselves of the responsibility of doing anything
I'm
about
shocked.
It, which leaves the state courts, and that is what this lawsuit is about.
This one lawsuit, one of 16.
One of 16.
One
well,
of
there,
16.
There might be others, but depending on how
there
this shakes
be.
Out.
Well, we're gonna wrap all this up and put a bow on it, and Aaron's going to make you feel better after he's told us all this hopeless, terrible stuff.
I was very hopeful. There are two very easy ways of resolving
this
issue.
That's right. There's two very easy ways.
One of them is unlikely right
yes.
now, but they can do
yeah.
it whenever they want. The other one is currently making its way through the process.
It's possible. Yeah, so our fingers are crossed for that one. So we're talking to Aaron Keck, and we're hoping for the best. And we're going to be back with our final moments in just a minute. You're listening to 97.9 The Hill. Well, we're back with the famous Aaron Keck, who has a curious relationship with Gomer Pyle. Who knew? We're just going to leave that
no,
over
we're not going to tell you what we were talking
no,
about
No, we're not going to tell you what
Absolutely
we're talking
Absolutely not.
That would just give it away. But
yeah.
I know one listener in Michigan who knows what we're talking about.
Maybe.
arguably, it could be, maybe. So, okay. Well, so the likelihood, we think, is that the case in North Carolina that's on point about gerrymandering is going to end up in the hands of the Supreme Court.
State Supreme Court. So we're following this trial that's happening on the state level, but honestly, whatever the outcome of this trial is, and we haven't gotten the ruling yet from the judges, we won't for a little while, whatever they end up ruling, there's going to be an appeal. The appeal will go, I think, through the state court of appeals, and then whatever the outcome of that is also doesn't really matter because there's going to be an appeal up to the state Supreme Court. And from the people that I've talked to, and the time frame on this can vary based on how long it takes the courts to issue their respective rulings, but the thought is that the state Supreme Court will probably get this challenge by the end of the calendar year, so maybe November, December of 2019, maybe a ruling in early 2020-ish, thereabouts.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've been talking about, okay, we've got partisan gerrymandering. It makes a travesty out of our electoral systems. This is not me talking. I mean, it is me
it's
talking.
Just the results.
But there's widespread public opinion on this, like bipartisan support for partisan gerrymandering is ridiculous. We need to get rid of it. Federal court said we're not going to touch it, which, OK, fair enough. But the state court still can, and the state Supreme Court can rule that partisan gerrymandering violates the state constitution, which also has its own equal protection clause. And once the state court rules on the state constitution, that's the state Supreme Court is the final arbiter on what the state constitution says. You can try to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the federal judiciary almost never gets involved in how to interpret a state constitution. This is what happened in Pennsylvania in 2018. Someone filed a lawsuit challenging partisan gerrymandering in Pennsylvania on the state level. State Supreme Court ruled that partisan gerrymandering was unconstitutional. You've got to redraw the district lines in a nonpartisan way. It did get appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yeah, we're not taking this case.
We don't do that, right.
And so the district lines did end up getting drawn, and it did make a big difference in the outcome of the 2018 election. Again, not so much because the voters suddenly changed their minds, but because the outcome of who won and who lost was much more in line with how Pennsylvania voters actually went to the polls and voted. And we could see this in 2020.
So if they make a decision in January, is there time to redo the maps for the primary in our state?
It's a good question.
Which is a primary for both federal and state
elections. That is when all of this stuff becomes a little bit more relevant because you know Republican lawmakers are going to say, oh, gosh, we just don't have enough time.
We just can't do it.
And then that's when all of this information becomes relevant of, yeah, actually, you've made this argument before and it was a lie.
Well, and why would
they? We're not going
to
listen to
why would they
time?
Kick it back to the Republicans to redraw the lines?
They can appoint a special master to draw lines. We've had that already in North Carolina.
Yeah, they should do that.
Yeah, there are things that can happen. State Supreme Court, as it happens, is 7 members and 6 of them are Democrats right now. So.
Yeah.
Partisanship really should not matter when it comes to judicial decisions, but insofar as you've got a 6-to-1 Democratic majority and Republicans are the ones who benefit from the lines being where they are, you might have a more likely outcome of more likely that you'll have a favorable outcome in terms of finally ending this practice in North Carolina.
I would just say to you that, you know, I have a lot more confidence in the Democrats that they are going to say, we're going to lock down here a process that makes sure that everybody who can vote gets to vote.
And again, it's not even
that it ends up fair.
This is not, nor should it be, a partisan issue, right?
Correct.
And like rank and file Republicans, you do a survey of voters in North Carolina. Democrats are in favor of ending partisan gerrymandering. Independents are in favor of ending it. Republicans are in favor of ending it. It's the lawmakers in the General Assembly who are sticking with partisan gerrymandering, not because it's a Republican issue, but because they personally stand to benefit. And
It's an individual who got elected into power and wants to stay there issue.
One of the most important lessons that I take from reading American founding era documents, like I'm a big fan of James Madison, and his line is, look, you cannot rely on people to do the right thing. You cannot rely and assume that people in power are going to do the right thing. You have to at least take it as a possibility that people, when they are given power, are going to use it to their own advantage. And then you have to set up your system so that when that happens, it's okay
that the system will handle it.
The system will handle it.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is a procedural matter.
And that is what this is about.
And it is. And I thank you for wrapping it up that way because, like golf, you know, there have been occasions, not many, but there have been occasions. There was a year or two ago in the U.S. Open where the outcome of the championship was determined by a player disqualifying himself by making a ruling on, it was Dustin Johnson just a couple of years ago in the U.S. Open had hit a shot out of a waste area that he didn't realize had been designated as a hazard, as a bunker. But there had been, you know, the crowds had walked through it and trampled in it, and he put his club down on the ground in that area before hitting a shot, which you're not allowed to do. So he had to dock himself a stroke, and that cost him the championship. This happened many years ago, 1968, in the Masters, when the champion, in fact, had incorrectly filled out his scorecard and discovered this as they were about to checking his scorecard as he's about to receive his green jacket and his oodles of money, I would point out. And you know, it would have resulted in a tie, which he maybe would have subsequently won, but instead he was disqualified. So he didn't just lose a stroke. He was like, you're out of the championship and you get not a penny from your week of work.
We know these stories because the people involved made a mistake and fessed up to it.
That's right.
We don't know the stories about the ones who made a mistake and didn't.
That's true, although I have to tell you that in this day and age, it's very – in golf at least, not so much in politics maybe, but in golf, it's very difficult to be out in the open spaces and cheat because there are – everybody's got a camera and not just the television coverage, but – and they can – they often have viewers call in and say, hey, it looks like he, you know, he disturbed his ball or, you know, whatever, and players have – had this pointed out to them, and then they've correctly scored it that way when they may not have even seen it. The ball moves when they're putting, this sort of thing. And so they're out there in the wide open now. it's like body cameras and policing.
There you go.
Aaron Keck, as always.
Thank you.
A joy to have you.
Thank you so much.
And come back soon. Thanks for being with us. Everyone, go out and have a great weekend and be ready to vote, vote, vote next year. Every time they ask you, get out there and vote. Have a good weekend.
Follow Gene on Twitter at Gene Bolduc and tweet your comments and questions with the hashtag WCHL.